seconding tonight's speakers. Who is Tollis?
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Dan. I'm Tollis, I'm an addict. And, thanks, Chris, for asking me to do the chair tonight. It's nice to come to this meeting. It's Friday, it's busy, and it's a very well-organized meeting, and I like that. I like meetings that you go and there is cup of tea and coffee there. There are people caring about the meeting. Makes me feel safe, makes me feel that that's home. And Joel described using very good, and it's my story too. The only difference is I wasn't homeless. I was living in derelict buildings. And and that, I suppose, makes it better, doesn't it? And my last of two or three years of my using, my father gave me a little room in the basement of his hotel, which was between the boiler room and the laundry room. So it was never quiet, and it was very warm in there, especially in the summer in Greece, where I come from and where most of my using happened. And I was happy there because I was on my own with my dog, and my dog understood me. Nobody else did at the time. And this year in September, the European Convention is happening in my hometown, Athens. And it's about 2 or 3 miles from where most of my using happened. And I keep threatening my homeboys from in Athens that I'm going to descend with all my friends from there. I'm going to take over Athens. And they say, keep coming back. I always like to share on a topic rather than telling you my personal story, which I can summarize in 3 or 4 sentences. I was a heroin addict. At one point, I saw my life going down the drain. I had lost my mind, I had damaged my body, I had no friends, and my family didn't want to know me. So, with all these good references, I left Greece and I came to England to get a methadone script, which was my answer to everything. I thought that would be paradise. Every day I have my methadone and then I can get on with my creative, productive life. Unfortunately, I went to the wrong place. And when I asked for my medication, they said, come back next week. Not come back next week, next Wednesday, we have something for you. I said, "Ma, it's Thursday today. Until next Wednesday, it's a few days. He said, you have to be patient." So I thought, okay, I'll grin and bear it, and hopefully it will be something good on next Wednesday. And it was a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And to my luck, there was somebody who came to do the H&I meeting, as we call it, in a suit. And I thought, I had enough of these experts. I had enough of all of these people who know what it feels to use or not to use. But the third week I was in there, a woman came and she shared her story, and it touched me, and it really meant something to me. And I could see faintly a little bit of, you know, hope springing in my life. Her name was Miracle Viv, and I found out later because of her story. And I always think of her, and I always feel that connection, that because she gave me the key to open up a little bit of willingness to see what Narcotics Anonymous is. And I'm not going to apologize. I'm very passionate about her name. I love Narcotics Anonymous. For me, it was a love affair. I fell in love. I can't describe it any other way. Exactly the same feelings. Quite a lot of times was for the wrong reasons. I went to my first meeting in Hampstead on a Wednesday night, and this beautiful blonde woman came up to me, sat next to me and said to me, "Are you a newcomer?" I said, "Yeah." She kissed me and she said, "You'll be fine. Just keep coming back." And in my mind, that's all I needed. I was sold to the idea. And but what happened was, after the initial, "I am different, I come from abroad, I'm not like him or like her," I started listening to the stories. I started liking the idea of collectively we can do it. I'm an old hippie, so these things, you know, immediately was fine for me. When it came to God and higher power, I was struggling a bit, but I thought, leave it out, you know, never mind. When it comes to that point, you know, I'll tackle that. And I'm very grateful because a lot of people took time out to pick me up from home and take me to a meeting and take me back, voted me in to be the secretary of a meeting or to do the tea and coffee at a meeting. They remembered my name, they acknowledged me in meetings, and that was, I suppose, the key thing that first attracted me to MA. That was the major thing that in my first few months kept me coming back. And the blonde one, of course. Until she invited me to dinner at her place and I met her boyfriend. I thought she tricked me. Or she couldn't see my potential. But on a serious note, the first few months were excruciatingly difficult. I felt very lonely, very different, and I couldn't see it working for me. I couldn't believe it. And I remember I was walking through Hyde Park one day with some guy who was an old-timer in my eyes, was a couple of years clean, and I asked him, I said, "You know, this is my life, you know, I've never worked, I haven't got any qualifications, I don't think I'm stupid, but I don't see me succeeding in this thing called life." And he said to me, "Tolly, stay clean and you'll be all right. Everything then takes you to the same place. Whatever job you do, whoever you are with, whatever, wherever you live, you are in the same place." And I thought, yeah. But what does he mean? And a lot of it has been like this in my experience in NA. Today's reading was about character defects. I came to a Narcotics Anonymous and I thought, yes, I like this program, but leave it out. I'm not going to sit down and write about the steps. You know, it's not college, this thing. You know, I'm not interested. I live the steps. I don't work them in a paper, etc. At 3 years, I found myself very miserable, thinking that it's not worth it staying clean. And one day, I'm sitting in a coffee shop with a friend of mine, and he says, "You know, I've been telling you for the last few months how much I like Jane." I said, "Yeah, you keep saying that, but you're not doing anything." He said to me, "Yeah, you keep saying I'll need to get a sponsor, but you're not doing anything." I said, "Watch me. In a week, I'll have a sponsor." And I made a mistake. I asked somebody who was very serious about the program. And he was really tough. First of all, he said, "You're going to call me every day for the first few months." I said, "Yeah, of course." But when I then said to myself, when he says every day, he means, you know, every couple of days, 3 days, you know. So I called him 3 days later. He said, "Didn't we say we called me every day?" I said, "Here we go. I don't like him." And anyway, I started, you know, talking about the steps with him, etc., etc., and he insisted we read the steps together, so I had no choice but to read them. And when we arrived at step three, he said, we read the step three together, and he said, "Now we'll pray together." Now, you won't believe it, but this was one of the most difficult things for me to do. I don't know why. I'm not sure if I believed it or didn't believe it, but we kneeled together, and I was praying like this, you know, watching him. I don't know what I was scared. He was an old man, but I don't know what I was scared of. And he said a few words, and I repeated them, and then say, "That's it, I'm in." And I jumped like a spring, boing, because I couldn't handle the idea of praying with somebody else. And immediately he said, "Okay, let me show you how you work step four." And I said, "Hang on a minute, we're going too fast here." He said, "What's the point in waiting? What is the point in waiting?" And I never thought of that. And quite a few times, you know, I in my program and working as a sponsor with other people, I saw that procrastination makes me and other people miss opportunities. I have a sponsee, he's been my sponsee for over 20 years, and he wanted to make amends to his father. And he kept saying, "Not yet, not yet, not yet." 2 years passed, and then his father passed away. And that's his biggest regret. Although his father saw him clean, it's his biggest regret. And I've learned from that. I've learned from him that if I need to do something, I better get on and do it. Not that I always do that. And today's reading was about character defects, and we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We worked the steps with my sponsor, and when we came to step four, he gave me a list and said, "Here you write the resentment, here you write, you know, what happened, the person, what happened, the resentment, and then you write the character defects." And he gave me a list of 16 character defects to look at. Now, when I did that, you know, before I started writing, I said, "I don't have this, I don't have this, I don't have this. I don't have any of them." I said, "That would be easy for me." And then when he started explaining what each character defect meant, I was shocked with the repetition of those character defects in my life. Pride, self-pity, selfishness, and self-centeredness. Arrogance were always there for me. And when you write about the incidents, when I started writing the incidents in my life, and then writing the character defects, I was shocked. I was shocked how much I realized that I wasn't wired up in the right way. As a person, I was wired up. My makeup was not right. There was something fundamentally not right with me. Now, people say character defect is a strong word. Let's use behavior patterns, or let's use something else. I don't care. I was suffering because of those. I still suffer because of those. And I suffer. Today, it was a very quiet day for me. And I experienced the same feelings I was experiencing as a kid. That thing of, I feel isolated from people, I feel lonely, I feel a restlessness in me. And it's the same thing that I felt as a kid. And you said something about dreaming and trying to escape reality that way. And last year, I spent most of my time in hospital. I had a bad liver, and I had a liver transplant. So when people say I'm here by the grace of God and Narcotics Anonymous, I put NHS as well. And my, I suppose, escape from the painful reality of my situation was to dream of being in a Greek island and being nice, restful, you know, healing my body after the operation, the successful operation, and trying to, you know, find a little bit more spirituality in my life and spending time meditating, going for walks with my dog. And it's funny how far you can take these things. I was so visualizing all these things, and I was visualizing sitting in a particular rock on a beach that I spent some time as a young guy. And I was visualizing being on the beach, the sun, the sound, and the dog coming and putting his head, her head, over here. And I was feeling happy. My reality hadn't changed, but I was feeling happy without being self-destructive by taking more drugs. And I was in pain, and they wanted to give me drugs. And I took the drugs they gave me, and I felt it very strong in me. And I said, I don't want any more. He said, aren't you in pain? I said, yeah, but I don't want any strong drugs. He said to me, we give you paracetamol then. I said, okay, give me paracetamol. And the thing is, the difference was that I was expecting the nurse to say, well done, Tollis. Fantastic. That's it. You're working your program. She said, all right, we give you paracetamol. Don't you understand? But the character defects are still there. And a lot of the times I spend time justifying my behavior. When I was in hospital, I put a lot of pressure on my wife. I was demanding, and I suppose she was the only person I could really show my frustration. And I made a mistake. I made a lot of mistakes. I think I hurt her because she was trying her best. And it just took me time. Once I came out of hospital and recovered a little bit, I started seeing it. I started seeing how selfish I was, so how self-centered I was. I mean, in one hand, maybe justifiable, but on the other hand, it wasn't. And I should have had more, you know, awareness of what was happening, but I just couldn't. And that's my, since then, my efforts have been to change that. And it took discussions with friends, you know, a few good friends by the side of the bed, who put me right, and my sponsor. And this is what this program has given me, the ability to say, okay, I've made mistakes, doesn't make me the worst person in the world, just makes me human, and I need to do something to make amends. Doesn't mean everything is lost. And that's the, I suppose, the beauty that before I never had that. I always used to burn bridges, and I ended up a very lonely person, a very damaged and lonely person. And when I suppose my sponsor was talking about character defects, you know, in some incidents, it wasn't I who instigated the wrongdoing, but it was I who was carrying it, that I hadn't let go. And he pointed that out to me, and he said, Tollis, it's never late to have a happy childhood, meaning that I can look at my childhood not with the eyes of a child, but with the eyes of an adult, and then I can move on. I can see what was mine, what was other people's, and I can move on. And that took a lot of time, and a lot of, in the beginning, I was so close to this idea. I was very close to this idea, but slowly, slowly, I opened up. The other thing is I suffered from, you know, a couple of illnesses and, you know, Hep C, etc. I'm HIV positive. I lost my, you know, I had to have a transplant for my liver. I can't hear very well. And quite often, I go to my sponsor these days and I say, but why me? And the answer is always the same. Why not you? Which is a hard thing, but it makes me snap out of it. And the other thing is, live responsibly, and leave the rest up to God. And that is a fantastic piece of advice. It's not sympathy. It's not, you know, although he says, I understand how you feel. And the warmth I get from him, but the guidance I get from him at the same time is amazing. It's amazing because he doesn't, I suppose, treat me in a way that, you know, a social worker would. Social worker would try and say, you know, oh, you're entitled to these benefits. He said to me, one of the things he says quite often to me, he says, if you act disabled, you'll feel disabled, and you'll become disabled. And that really opened my eyes to try and be, not to be a victim. And up to now, I refuse to be a victim. I try and live life to the fullest, and I try to, you know, as much as I can, to enjoy, you know, every moment in my life. And it's controversial. I know it's controversial what he said, and it's hard. But at the same time, all the years, you know, until I had the transplant, when I was diagnosed, I was 8 years clean. And I thought, and I was paying a pension up to then. And I was thinking, I'm going to give up. I don't need to pay a pension. I'm going to snuff it soon. And he said to me, my sponsor said, live responsibly, leave the rest up to God. Now, I'm not one of the God squad. I'm not an atheist either. To be honest with you, I don't really know what I am. I'm open. I'm just staying open to everything. And I thought, okay, I'm going to pay the pension, and if it's wasted money, it's your fault. And I paid it, and, you know, when I was in hospital, etc., I was made redundant on, you know, on health grounds, and I got a pension. Now, that wasn't the plan, but it worked somehow. And until now, you know, I've always tried to prove my sponsor wrong. I said, okay, I'll try it, but I don't believe it will work this time. I was made redundant in the past, and I was looking for a job, and he said to me, Tolis, this is not the right job for you. I said, how do you know? He said, well, let me put it this way. You have a career that goes A, B, C, D, F. So suddenly you're going to start something else, which your heart is not into it, which is not something you know about, and is not, you're not particularly excited about. How can this be the right thing for you? And I said, all right, I'll try it, but if I can't pay the mortgage, it's your fault. And it worked out perfectly right after that. And my character defects are so strong and so deep ingrained that despite all the work and all the, I suppose, revelations and, you know, things I've learned in the program, I still don't have that strong faith that everything is going to be all right. People said to me, oh, you look good after the transplant. They say, yeah, for time being on, yeah. Because somehow I expect, you know, that my life will turn up into, you know, I'm going to die on my own in some, you know, bedsit, you know, without money for the meter. That's my, for an incurable disease. That's my sort of default setting. And so far it has proved that the opposite happens to me. Coming to character defects, again, the one thing I'm trying to work out at the moment is procrastination. And my sponsor also were discussing this, and I said, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to do the other thing. He said to me, Tolis, you have just 3.5 months ago, you had a very big operation. you can take it easy, it's okay. I said, no, but I don't want to procrastinate. He said to me, this is not procrastination. It's putting one foot in front of the other. It's different thing. It's doing things within what is appropriate and what is within your capability, the physical capability. So I said, okay, take your word, I'll practice it. So last Sunday I went to play football and I hurt my back, so I couldn't walk for 3 days. I went home and I said to my wife, I hurt my back, somebody need me. She said to me, are you stupid or something? You are an old man who had a new liver 3.5 months ago. What were you doing playing football? I said, maybe you see me like this. I don't see me like that. Put your glasses on. And that's the one thing I am grateful to NA is that has always been a soft cushion for me to help me through the difficult times and to guide me through the difficult times. I talked about my father briefly, and when he hadn't spoken to me for a few years, apart from coming down to that basement room every morning and throwing me a packet of cigarettes and then not saying anything and closing the door. After a while, that routine got me, and I said, why don't you ever fucking talk to me? And he said, Tolis, what is there to say? You're not a well man. There is nothing we can talk about. And that was after I saw him crying. He's holding his hand, crying and saying, begging me to tell him where I went wrong, where he went wrong. He said, tell me, Tolis, where did I go wrong? And of course, I had a list of where he went wrong, which none of it was true, because, anyway. And only when I wrote my step four, I realized what I was doing. Up to then, I didn't realize at all, even when I was clean. Because on my step four, I wrote, my father was not there when I was growing up. The truth is, my father left Egypt, went to Greece, and was working two jobs to support his family. Because in the 1965, when we turned up in Greece, there was a time of unemployment, everybody was very poor, so my dad had to work two jobs to support our family. And because I was left in my house on my own with my grandmother, I used to jump the fence of the house and disappear from the age of four. And that's how I become a bit of a wandering spirit. And that's why I always looked at outside other people as role models rather than the family. And when I cleaned up, my first 2 years, my father didn't speak to me. Then we started speaking, but it was always a bit distant. It wasn't a father and son discussion or atmosphere. And when I was about 5 years clean, he had a heart operation, and I looked after him after the operation. So I used to moan to my sponsor that I couldn't go to meetings. So, I can't really look after him, I can't go to meetings. He said to me, Tolis, forget this. Your recovery is about you are to change you as a person, so you are there for the people you care about, not for going to meetings. Going to meetings is the vehicle, it's not the purpose. The purpose is for you to be of service to the people around you. And, okay. So I would go to only one meeting a week. And it was amazing because slowly I started enjoying my father's company. We'd play backgammon, we'd watch football, and, we'd talk about his youth and his stories. And when he was about to fly back, we're waiting for the plane, and he He didn't say much. My dad wasn't very much a person of feelings. He always did his duty as he saw it, and he always told me to do the same. And said, last call for the flight so-and-so for Athens. So he stood up and he said to me, Tolis, I'm really proud of you. You are the son I always wanted to have. And, you know, it's somehow, for the first time, I felt equal with him. I felt that all this we do here, that I question all the time, why do I need to do service? Why do I need to do this? Why do I need to go to meetings? Why do I need to look at myself? Why do I need to write? Why do I need to read? Why do I need to, you know, talk on the phone? Blood is considered ringing again. I want to watch football. I want to have dinner. Suddenly, there is one word that somebody says, and everything falls into place. And and to give you an example of how service works, and I know Robert says quite often, do it and do it for the hell of it. And for many years, I took an H&I meeting only once a month in South London. And I used to go in, say hello to the nurses and stuff. Then I would go into the common room where people would be watching television. So I said to them, would you like to come to the meeting? So I would get all the, not today, you know, occasionally, you know, I would corner one of them. So I said to one person, are you going to come to the meeting? He said, nah. I said, why not? He said, I'm watching EastEnders. So clever Tolly says, how is EastEnders going to keep you clean? So I could see the fuck off in his eyes. and of course, I have to respect what they decide. So I left. A few years later, I think a couple of years later, somebody comes in the meeting and says to me, do you remember me? I said, no. He said, not really. He said, I was in that hospital when you came in and you told me, how is EastEnders going to keep you clean? I said, oh, sorry about that. I know sometimes I overstepped the line. He said, no, it was great. It was great because next week I went to the meeting. And he's here today and he asked me to do the chair. And to do the chair here. And that's how this program works. It's not about you know, expecting miracles to happen instantly, but I'm so blasé now about seeing miracles in this room. And I think everybody who comes here, cleans up, and stays in this program is a miracle. And it's a miracle that unfolds constantly, because, you know, in my life, what has happened to me happens also to people around me, has an effect on people around me. And I sponsored people, and they're now, you know, we're 20 years clean. And now our relationship is not of sponsorship as much as of friendship. Of, you know, I respect them now. They have their own wisdom and their own experiences to share with me. And they taught me a lot of things on the way. They taught me, you know, dignity, and they told me, you know, respect, and they told me, you know, to be open-minded, and told me that, you know, sometimes I have to let people decide what is best for them in their lives, because many times I'm, oh, no, this doesn't sound very good to me, you know, and they say, no, I'll try it, and it works for them. I think, I'm sure we are
about
5 minutes.
Yeah, five.
And so coming back to the character defects, I think they are the bits in me, in my wiring, that really makes me suffer. Not because I'm caning myself, but they do make me suffer. And this, you know, there is one example of it is how you can be tenacious about something and how you can be stubborn about something. And you know something? I don't really know the fine differences between these things. Sexual desire towards somebody is fine. Lust is not. And where is the balance between the two things? Because as a human being, to have sexual desire towards another is fine, but it has to come with dignity, it has to come with honesty, it has to come with some degree of commitment. But lust is using the other person. And, you know, I put my hand up, I've done that. In every character defect that, you know, I can look at, I've been guilty. Some of them, a lot more than others. Arrogance is a strong one for me. And the worst thing about it is that it's undercover arrogance. Mm-hmm. It's not extrovert arrogant, but I cover it very well. Because people say to me, oh, you're so humble. I said, yeah, right. And because I'm opinionated. When I believe in something, I believe it strongly. And that can be a good thing, but it can be also the wrong thing. And I have a lot of friends that we got clean together, and we believe in different things about the problem. And I usually use phrases from my sponsors because they are safer, proven, and usually more clever than I can come up with. And my sponsor talks about the program being a loose-fitting garment, that you can wear it, but it's loose. It's not tight. It's not, you know, it's not something that struggles you. I think Michael has heard that. And I feel that that's correct, you know. That's the right thing for me. But also, I don't compromise. I don't really compromise in certain things, that, as in going to meetings, talking to newcomers. And a lot of the times, you know, talking to newcomers, I'm not talking to tell them what to do and what the program is and how it works and how it doesn't work. I'm just befriending them. We have a laugh, we have a joke, we can, you know, take the piss out of each other, the banter, because that makes things warmer, I feel. That suits me. Maybe it doesn't suit everybody, but it suits me. And when I was in hospital, I felt that love from people I got clean with and lived with and spent many years together, but I also felt it from people who I knew in the program. And it was great. It was great. Every time I needed something and I picked the phone, people just dropped everything and came to help me. And that had a major effect on me. It made me feel very loved. Very, very loved to the core. And I remind myself of this every day, because, you know, when I'm talking about the character defects, the character defects are motivated in me, at least, from fear. Fear that I won't be enough, I won't get enough, I won't be loved enough, I won't whatever this, I'm not enough. Mm-hmm. And when I felt so loved, all this disappeared. I am okay. I'm okay who I am, what I do, what I look like, what this, that, and the other. I wish I was young, of course I would do. But when that core thing changed, or changing, because I still feel the effects of that. I still feel it. I walk into NA meetings and I feel home. I feel like, you know, when in theory, you know, you're supposed to go into your family and feel really loved by everybody and warm and, you know, like American, you know, films for kids, you know, that type of thing. And my reality was not like that. My reality was never like that at home. I was always the odd one out. And I don't feel the odd one out anymore. I don't feel the odd one out in NA or my family. I feel the differences, about the dreams and aspirations and stuff. But I don't feel the odd one out. Even when I was in hospital, my niece, we have a peculiar relationship because when I was using, I came out of detox once and I wanted to go out and use, but my parents and my sister and stuff, they were all watching me. So I said, I'm going to take my niece to the swings, legitimate reason. And she said, yeah, 4 years old. So I took my niece to the swings and I left her and I went to school. Now, how irresponsible can you get? Leave a 4 year old in the swings and disappear. When I say disappear, it wasn't in watching her. I was probably about 10 blocks away. And my brother-in-law was passing the swings, saw her, picked her up. So I came back to the swings and she's not there. So stoned, panicked, and feeling really shitty about myself, I called home and they said, she's here. Don't you dare show your face here. And I remember that, and ever since, my sister is a pharmacist, so in the beginning I used to go there, hi Angie, how are you, you know, this, that and the other, steal some drugs, walk away. She found out, and she didn't want me anywhere near her place, her home, or her business. And over the years, this changed, you know, slowly. And when I was in hospital, my niece used to call me every day, saying, she kept saying to me, I'm only interested in my family. I'm only interested in my family. How are you? How are you? How are you? And it's funny because we just rediscovered each other through my illness. So sometimes when they say, you know, sometimes, you know, even in bad things you can see the silver lining, I can't pretend that being in hospital and having a new liver was, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me after, you know, I was about to snuff it, after I lost my ability to stand, talk, you know, remember, couldn't remember things. So I am I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.